Hello and welcome to this episode of Bank FinTech Fusion. This is Philip Ryan, and I'm joined today by my friend Chris Hansen of Coho and Portage, and he's going to tell us a little bit about both these companies and hopefully a lot more. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Philip. So I'm the CTO at Coho Financial and Portage Ventures. Portage Ventures is a venture capital fund focused primarily on fintech and insurtech. And Coho Financial is Canada's leading challenger bank, focused on shaking things up in terms of digital financial services.
Excellent. So, Chris, how did you wind up in financial services? Was there something that intrigued you about the industry early on getting into it?
Yeah, I mean, so it was a couple of things. So, you know, I had started my career, building an internet company. And somehow I evolved to be building software for government in the Hawaiian Islands and started to do a bit of financial services, insurance, and banking. And I guess the first thing that I noticed was like what a target-rich environment financial services is for technology. Yeah. And, you know, having come from a fairly lean sort of internet environment into oil and gas, into government, into financial services, my first impression was, wow, like, you know, first of all, like everything in the business is information, you know, all the debits and credits, it's all information, it's all code, it's all software. And wow, look at all the work that can be done here. So that was kind of how I started. When I moved back to Canada, I took a role with a bank. And that bank wanted to change out their core banking system. And I was, you know, I was young and naive at the time. I thought, well, this will be easy. Let's rip out the core and put in a new one.
A couple of weeks. Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, you know, sure, why not? You know, let's do it. And in fact, when they were hiring me, they didn't tell me that they were going to do all of this. But they said that they were going to do some interesting things and that I would enjoy it. We ended up doing a four-year project where we replaced about 90% of all the technology in the bank. They had about 1 million customers. And it was like, for me, it was, you know, I had dabbled in financial services in advance of that. I had done some, you know, modernization work at a few banks and a few insurance companies. But this was like a deep dive. And, you know, you really learn about a business and you learn about a system when you blow the old one up and you have to build a new one. You really have to think about the essentials behind the process, the essentials behind the business. And so I consider that to be sort of my first real introduction into the industry. And that was kind of around, like it started in 06 and sort of, was sort of 4 years from that.
I remember when I met you around 2012, you had this basically like a map of a bank, which I think is part of the result of what you're talking about. You had mapped all these processes and this connected there. It looked like a circuit board or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's funny when you meet people, when you meet people in banks and you talk to them and they, you know, if they're wealth management experts or if they're lending experts or if they're, you know, core deposits experts, There's a lot of knowledge just in that one, you know, sort of area. And like very seldom do you get a chance to sort of zoom out and take a look at the entire business and then zoom in and be able to see like each process. So like in some ways it was a very tough project. It was a very painful project. It was something to endure, but it was also like an incredible learning experience that I probably draw on that, you know, even now as I think about, you know, how should this work? You know, what are the first principles here in terms of this type of structure and things like that?
Right. So now you mentioned you have a dual role. What's the greatest challenge facing, I guess either one of those roles or both of those roles? What's the thing that's keeping you up at night right now?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, one of the great things about these roles is that they are very different. My role at Coho is, you know, being a CTO of a startup firm is very hands-on. You know, when I joined Coho as the fourth engineer, you know, there's not really an advisory role there. You need to roll up your sleeves and start writing some code. You know, and I think that, you know, Coho is scaled now. You know, the technology team is about 40 people, and we're continuing to build it. We're continuing to scale. I would say the biggest challenge at Coho is it's more of a leadership evolution challenge where I need to, you know, because we're scaling so quickly and we're growing and, you know, where the team is evolving, you know, every few weeks I need to kind of take a look at my role and take a look at what I'm doing and say, well, you know, what do I need to scale? What do I need to change? What do I need to stop doing? What do I need to do more of? And I need to kind of evolve myself. Like, it's very easy, I think, as a human to get comfortable doing something that you've been doing. But I think, you know, being in a startup, because of the sort of constant change, the scale is really, the challenge is really about scale. Now, in my Portage role, one of the great things about this role is I get to talk to like 2 to 5 CTOs a week because we're looking at different businesses, we're looking at investing. And I really enjoy like talking to other CTOs and getting a sense of like what's working, what's not working.
You can steal all their good ideas, right?
Well, I think like, you know, what's great is that I come with credibility and experience that's like as recent as 20 minutes ago, where we can have a conversation about, you know, things that are pretty pragmatic. We can talk about leadership. Sometimes I learn something, sometimes I share something. But I feel like I'm a better technologist for it, and I always try and sort of leave something useful behind. So I would say the biggest challenge in that role though is you know, really thinking about like, well, what is like, you know, what does good look like? And so, you know, and this is something that I've found over time is that the more knowledge and context that I gain, the more it depends is the right answer. And so if you ask me like, well, what does good look like? Is this, you know, is the technology in this firm good? Is it strong? And, you know, so, you know, what I've had to do is try and simplify that down into a due diligence framework and a model to be able to say that, yeah, you know what, this technology is appropriate for this business. This is going to work. This is going to scale. This is going to be, you know, low risk and high yield. And so trying to kind of codify that, I would say is the challenge. You know, I think like similar to Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, where like, I think over time you get a sort of a, you know, just sort of a visceral kind of a gut feel for, yeah, that's it. That's going to work. That's right. But then having to sort of, you know, codify that, explain that, simplify that, structure that, I think is always a challenge.
Yeah, no, I can see a real symbiosis between those two roles. That must be pretty interesting to be on both sides of the table that way.
Could also use about another 10 hours in a day.
Yeah, yeah, that's a little tougher. So you've had a lot of experience over your career working with fintech companies, obviously, and working with banks. So this podcast is all about banks and fintechs working together. What would you say is the key, if you can reduce it to one thing or multiple things, what's the key to bring banks and fintechs together to work effectively?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've seen this work really well, and I've seen it, you know, fall pretty flat. And you know, so I think that like one of the key ingredients that I think is essential is, you know, the chemistry around the commitment. Like if you've got a senior person in the fintech, you know, maybe one of the founders, and a senior person in the bank, and both are committed and both are, you know, really clear about, you know, what the other is doing and are transparent about their own organizations, are honest about, you know, where their own organizations are at. I think that becomes a conduit for the partnership that creates success. I think as soon as there's a lack of transparency, as soon as there is, you know, as soon as there's a breakdown or if people change roles, you know, if things are working and then they change roles, without that ownership on both sides and without that, you know, sort of individual commitment on both sides, I think it struggles. And I've been on both sides of that, where I've been, you know, I've been on the bank side, and I've taken a risk with a partner, but I really believe that that's the right partner, that this is the right technology, this is the right team, and we can do big things together. And I've seen that work. And I've also been on the other side where, you know, I'm trying to be that partner, and I think I've got what it takes, and I'm, you know, sort of looking for a counterpart on the bank side that's willing to make the same level of commitment that I'm willing to make. And, you know, yes, the organizations are going to be, you know, hard to mesh, and yes, there's an impedance mismatch, and, you know, there's all kinds of challenges, but I think with that individual commitment on both sides, we can break through that, we can figure it out, we can resolve it, and make it successful. So to me, I think that's really the top ingredient. And a lot, you can kind of get past a lot if you have that.
So is that more of a personal thing than a cultural thing? It sounds like it, a lot depends on the personality of the other person, or is it more, you know, what the parameters of their role is?
Yeah, I've seen it in both ways. So I've seen it as, you know, the organization culture allows someone to be, you know, effectively an owner of this relationship to make this happen. And I've also, you know, seen it, you know, be more of a, you know, more of an individual sort of takes a risk, steps out, and, you know, effectively just makes it happen. I think it's like, I think on the fintech side, I think it's, you know, it's more about the transparency and, you know, making the commitment and delivering on the commitment. And I think on the bank side, it's more about having the ownership, having the empowerment, being able to take the risks, being able to break silos where you need to, being able to kind of, you know, move through things where you need to. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a bit different on each side of it.
Right. So what does success look like for bank partnerships with fintech? Obviously, I guess success could mean a different thing for each side of the table.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that success needs to be something that both organizations can go back to and point to, and it needs to be tangible. You know, I think, you know, we need to begin these relationships with commercials in mind and things like unit economics in mind and results in mind. And then we need to sort of lean into the partnerships to make those results happen. And I know, like, you know, on the startup side, if I go back to my board and I say, we have this great partnership, the first thing they're going to ask is, you know, what are the targets? What are the financials? What does this look like on the P&L? And I think we need to think about that in the partnership. I think the stage of, you know, let's do partnerships for mutual learning, I think that's behind us. You know, we've learned things already. I mean, if you're still learning now, at this stage, it's getting a bit late, right? We need these partnerships to be yielding. They need to be producing. And I think both organizations are, you know, they're wanting different things. You know, quite often the fintechs are wanting distribution from banks because banks have a strong incumbent base. Sometimes the banks are wanting to be able to offer something into their base that gives them a bit of a moat against, you know, maybe a competitive landscape. But whatever those targets are, like, you know, I believe in making things quantifiable, making them measurable, and then executing accordingly and checking in on those measurements and making sure that they're holding true. And so I think, you know, basically what success looks like is some sort of bottom line quantifiable result.
Right. Can you give us a little snapshot view of the Canadian banking market? I think for a lot of people in the US, it's still largely unknown. I think, you know, we know a few of the banks that have crossed the border, but, you know, what are the sort of idiosyncrasies that people in the US might not have heard about?
Yeah, I think looking, you know, so I've operated on both sides of the border, and you know, I've sort of understood sort of financial services from both sides of the border. I think when you look north, you know, not only does it look cold, but it also looks, you know, very similar, and you see, you know, Canadians, you know, speaking a similar language and doing similar things. I mean, we brought you Justin Bieber, who, you know, so things like that. Also Nickelback, we won't talk about that. But, you know, there's a real sort of, you know, a real similarity to the environments. There's a real similarity to the sort of business environments and business mindset. But the financial services landscape is significantly different. And, you know, I would say that the biggest difference is around how the payments move in Canada and payment structures. You know, a lot of things in the U.S. are like centered around and focused on ACH as a mm-hmm. format and structure for money movement. And so, you know, one of the things that I've seen is U.S. companies arrive in Canada and they're like, okay, this is great. This looks exactly like what I'm used to. Show me your ACH. And at that point they realize that, oh, okay, this is going to be a bit different.
They're not in Kansas anymore. Yeah.
You're not in Kansas anymore. And you know, so, and some of that comes from just the dynamics of banks in Canada are a bit different. We've got you know, basically six large banks and then like a long tail of you know, significantly smaller organizations, and those big banks are really formidable in their scale and their size. And you know, if you're a fintech and you're wanting to partner with those big banks, you know, again, it comes down to those relationships, because you can be talking with one department, and you know, they're not necessarily talking to the other department about what you're doing. I mean, some of these banks will have like 100,000 employees, right? So if you're talking to one, you're not necessarily talking to the others. So I think that's a big difference. Payment infrastructure, the sort of banking, you know, industry landscape is significantly different. I think in the U.S. you get a lot more community banks and smaller banks. Certainly there are some big players, but they don't necessarily capture the entire consumer market, right? There's a lot of smaller institutions as well.
Yep. And obviously still a need for challengers like KOHO.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, what I love about what we're doing at KOHO is, you know, we're not necessarily challenging the banks. We're challenging apathy, and we're challenging the norms, and we're challenging the concepts. Why do you need a checking account to be separate from a savings account? Why can't you just have like an account that does the stuff that you need it to do? You know, I think a lot of the concepts that we face in financial services are constructs from the 70s and 80s that mm-hmm. we're sort of stuck with. I personally don't use checks, and I understand some people really like them, but I personally don't use them. And so for me, what I'm looking for from a checking account has nothing to do with checking. It has everything to do with like digital notifications and alerts and awareness and tell me how my spending is doing. You know, tell me if you see something weird. Like, you know, the things that I want from my core account in 2020 is completely different from, you know, how I think the industry thinks about these things, which is, in my view, very sort of 1985-ish.
Yeah, there's vestigial pieces of, you know, that show the history of how we came to be where we are, that people are no longer use.
Yeah, absolutely. And having changed and replaced legacy technology, I can tell you that there's only one thing harder, and that's legacy thinking. And you know, when you change out a legacy platform, you bump into this legacy thinking, and it's, you know, people will come in very rigid. You can't do that. Well, why not? Because the system doesn't allow it. Well, the system is now gone, right? So you can almost see the constraints and the constructs that people are living in. When you do legacy transformation, it's amazing how, you know, you can open up these concepts, you can broaden these concepts out. And having, you know, basically built our technology from the ground up, you know, and having an amazing team of engineers that can build almost anything in about 3 weeks, it's an incredibly liberating feeling to know that we're not constrained by concepts, we're not constrained by legacy thinking, we're not constrained by legacy technology. We can just go.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about KOHO's customer base. What does a KOHO customer look like, and what do they want from their bank?
Yeah, it's, you know, when we started this journey, we thought this would be really simple. We thought this would be like, well, you know, we're going to do some digital stuff and it's going to be people that like digital. It's probably going to be millennials. Like, that, you know, that was sort of our, that was sort of our thinking when we started. What we found is that, you know, the people that are digital natives are, you know, kind of a broad cross section of just Canada. And, you know, so when we start to look at our segments, we're not so much looking at demographics, we're looking at behavior. And we're finding that, you know, some people love to use us as their primary account. They get their payroll with us, mm-hmm. they pay their bills, they pay their friends. They do all the normal stuff that people would do with a bank account. But then there are like this, these clusters of use cases. Some people only use us for big purchases. They buy their TVs with us. Mm-hmm. They, you know, they shop on Amazon with us. And, you know, when we think about, well, why is that? You know, it might be the cash back. It might be some of the, you know, purchase protection, price protection that we offer. You know, I'm not certain on all of the rationale, but you start to see these clusters emerge. Like there's an incredible cluster that really surprised me. Of retirees. And retirees, like, their behavior is they load up a bunch of money onto their Koho account and they head to a warmer climate and they spend the winter there, which I think is, first of all, really smart. and, you know, secondly, but then they've realized that, like, our FX fees are low and that it's a great way for them to kind of take their funds with them without having to worry about cross-border banking and stuff like that. So it's actually one of the more interesting journeys of this business has been, like, understanding all of the different use cases. And we'll put out, like, a capability on our platform, and we put it out there for the world, but they interpret it into their own use cases. Like, we have a savings construct called Goals, and some people are using Goals to save for, you know, things like a dishwasher or a Tesla. You know, so there are people that are saving right now for a Tesla on Koho. Other people use Goals more like transactionally as a monthly way of putting aside funds for their rent. Mm-hmm. So they're thinking, like, their goal this month is to pay their rent. Other people, their goal is to get a Tesla. Other people have goals for vacations. But I think it's interesting for us. You know, as a platform provider, we need to think about these concepts. We need to think about these features from a position of versatility. Like, this is what we're thinking, but how is the world going to interpret this? How are Canadians going to take this, and what are they going to do with it? And I think that's fascinating. Like, it's been a really interesting journey to just kind of look at what people are doing. For example, with our joint accounts, like, we originally, you know, envisioned it for, you know, people that are coupled up. And we thought, well, you know, this is a great way to, like, you know, nudge your partner to, like, pay half the internet bill. And isn't that an annoying thing to have to do? And what if we made that easier? And then we start to see all these great use cases, you know, people that are, like, you know, planning together for some major life event, people that are planning for, you know, various things that they want to have a joint account. And so, you know, if you come up with these constructs, you come up with these concepts, you sort of release them in the world, and then they sort of, the world does with it, you know, what they will.
What does your work at Portage tell you about the state of the industry today? We mentioned earlier you're on both sides of this thing. So what is that? What does that look like from the Portage point of view?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, in the last few years, I would say that, you know, the market has been really active. I think there's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of different business models that are evolving now that didn't exist 2 years ago. I think, you know, fintech was sort of an emerging space a few years ago, seemed a bit risky. And I think it's become, you know, much more front and center from an investment thesis perspective. I think there was a question years ago, like, well, will kind of meaningful models emerge? And I think now it's more of a given. I think there are questions as to the timing, and there are questions as to the, you know, the impacts and the scope and the scale. But I think in general, you know, we're seeing, you know, we're seeing a lot of traction. I would say both B2C and B2B models have been evolving.
Hmm. And we're getting a little bit short on time, but which currently developing technology or perhaps slightly future technology do you see having the greatest potential for helping out the financial services industry and its customers?
You know, I think that there's something very compelling about distributed financial services technology. And, you know, so, you know, without saying the word blockchain, but I did go and say it.
You know, it's not a dirty word. You can say that. You can say that on the radio.
Can you say that on the radio? But I mean, so like from a technology perspective, when you think about what's happening with peer-to-peer financial services technology, whether it's, you know, completely decentralized or semi-decentralized or, you know, some other model, what I find fascinating, what I find impressive, what I find amazing is that you have all of these people so excited about core banking. Like when I was a core banking technologist, you know who wanted to talk about core banking? Like nobody. There was no interest in the space. Nobody was thinking about money movement. Nobody was thinking about cross-border. Nobody was talking about KYC. Nobody was up against these problems and thinking about how to apply technology to solve these problems. Now, I think there are many people. I think we've seen some false starts and, you know, various challenges in this space, but I think there's still, you know, I have a lot of enthusiasm for distributed, decentralized financial services technology. I have a lot of enthusiasm for technology being a disruptor, you know, and basically creating new kinds of networks and new kinds of meshes and new kinds of trust relationships. So, you know, again, I think it's, you know, it's still pretty early days, but, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff that could emerge there.
I love hearing positive stuff about blockchain these days. The overall tenor is so downbeat, but it's good to hear about the bright side. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Philip. Thank you for having me.
Always good to talk to you. And thank you everyone for listening. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And check out the links below. We'll put links to all the stuff Chris is working on, Portage, Coho. And thanks again.